Welcome to In the Room with me, Ronnie Barber. In this series, we'll be talking to politicians, YouTubers, sports stars, and scientists about the defining moments of their lives. From the classroom to the boardroom, the briefing room, the dressing room, and a whole lot more, we'll find out how the rooms of our lives shape the decisions we make. This time in the room, I'm talking to Gail Porter, the TV presenter, documentary maker, and mental health advocate. We'll hear about the one job she really didn't want.
It was the days when, you know, you'd pick up the paper on a Sunday and there'd be some story about someone with, you know, stuff in the closet, skeletons in the closet.
How she almost became homeless.
I've worked so hard all my life and I've really tried and I've tried to be bubbly and then my hair fell out and I was just like, come on.
And what you'd say to the young Gail Porter?
I'd probably say to young Gail, better put a seatbelt on and get saving now.
Anyway, the first room I put her into was the dressing room at Top of the Pops where she got her big TV break.
Oh my gosh, I've got absolutely no idea, to be honest with you, what year it was. I think it must probably have been 1998, that sort of era. And yeah, well, we didn't have dressing rooms because we just would dress ourselves. And then we'd go in. And so, yeah, I just remember the taxi coming to pick me up. And I was living in Belsize Park at the time. And was it Belsize Park? Oh, I'm not very sure, actually. No. Anyway, I was living. No, I was in Soho. That's right. I was in Soho living. And then the car came to pick me up. And I just kept thinking, oh, my gosh, I'm going to Top of the Pops. I used to watch it on the telly with, like, Madonna's fingerless gloves on. Not actually Madonna's gloves. They were mine. But they looked like Madonna's ones. And then I'd be dancing around. And my dad would be like, sit down. What are you doing? I was like, oh, dancing away. And presented it. And then, bizarrely, I got a phone call from an agent saying, Top of the Pops are getting new presenters in and they'd like you to do next Thursday night. I think we recorded it on a Thursday and it went out on the Friday. I think that was right. And I just remember sitting in the car going, oh my gosh, oh my gosh. I got in and it was lucky because in those days, you know, the makeup artists, you probably have met them somewhere before because they were all sort of like dotting around doing all the different telly programmes and everyone was just super nice. All the staff, the director, the camera guy, everybody were just all excited because it's, you know, live music, mostly live music, and everyone was having a great time. And it's the times when you know, the bar was open, you'd have a glass of wine before you go on, stuff like just weird stuff that doesn't happen. Not we'd even go out now, but yeah, so you got in there, went in to get my hair and makeup done. Obviously, don't get my hair done now, but I was getting my hair and makeup done. And just the bands were coming in. And I can't remember who was on my first ever one, but I mean, we had everybody on from Prince to Blur to, you know, it was unbelievable. Madonna, we had, just remember sitting there and I was kind of nervous, but it wasn't until I got out onto the floor and all the kids are dancing around and all the kids were bigger than me. And I was like, oh, they had to get me a box because they couldn't see me over the kids because I'm only little. And so that was quite amusing. And the kids were great. And I'm quite good at remembering lines. So they just give me a card. I'd remember it. And then I was so nervous. I was like, it's still number one. It's Top of the Pops. It was so exciting.
Take me to there, because this is quite the journey, isn't it? Because you'd presented programs like Fully Booked and everything with Grant Stoughton and that. So you became a name anyway. But you were presented kind of, I see in Wikipedia, they said family friendly programs. But you were, almost a go-to girl for these kind of programs, that you were in that moment. Tell me about the journey to there, because you did your study at Wet's Hearts College in media production. Tell me about that journey then, from that point to Top of the Pops. What was it like, and had you always wanted to do television presentation?
I didn't want to be a presenter, no. I wanted to work behind the scenes. So after I did West Hearts, sorry, is that my cat in the background? After I did West Hearts College, I just wrote hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of letters, you know, handwritten letters, posted them to production companies saying, I'll do anything, I'll be a runner, which is, you know, anything from making tea, coffee, to babysitting people's kids, to picking up the dry cleaning. And loads of people got back to me saying, no, thank you, standard, no, thank you, no, thank you, don't need anybody. And then a company called InVideo in Edinburgh said, we need a runner. You could come in. And so I went in. They said, we don't have any money, of course.
Yes.
But will you be a runner for us? And it was a facilities house. So it was editing and all the rest of it. And they said, yeah, will you do it for free? So that was me. I just went in and did it for free for quite a long time. And I loved every minute of it. I was literally doing that, you know, picking up dry cleaning, doing the dishes, picking up the sandwiches. And it was a really nice bunch of people. It was hard work, but I really, really enjoyed myself. And then I went to a course to study avid editing in London. So I came back down to London, did a course, then went back up to Edinburgh again. And then I went to work for Piccadilly Television in Edinburgh. So I was their runner as well, sort of a runner assistant on anything whatsoever. You know, just whatever they needed done, I would do. And then I went down to London actually to babysit for a friend of mine who I was his assistant on a shoot that we did in Scotland. It was about women's rugby in Scotland. And I said, I fancy going to London for a bit. And he said, well, that'd be great because my wife's working, I'm working. You can stay, we've got a spare room and we've got two kids. I was like, perfect, I'll babysit. You guys can go and do your thing. And then one night I was in town in Soho and Mr. Guthrie, Derek, said to me, come, I'm in this place called the Groucho Club in London. And I'd heard it was quite posh.
Yeah.
So I was like, yeah, it's a members club for anyone that doesn't know. And I was like, oh, check me out, little girl from Portobello, going to the Groucho Club. And then I went to the Groucho Club and sitting in the corner was Peter Richardson from the comic strip.
Yes.
I'd written to the comic strip loads of times. So they'd actually been writing back to me because I was sending them like real, really weird, funny letters. Well, I thought they were funny. And they were getting back to me going, that's very amusing, but we don't need anybody at the moment. And then I said to my friend Derek, I said, that's Peter Richardson. I've been writing to him. And he said, go and say hello. You know, you're not going to be, it's the first time you've ever been in here. May as well give it a bash. You know, the worst thing he can do is tell you to bog off. So I went up and I said, Mr. Richardson, sorry to bother you, sitting on his own. He looked really scared. And I was like, my name's Gail and I'm from Edinburgh and I've been writing to you. And he went, Gail Porter? Like, oh yeah. He went, oh, do you want to come to the office? It's just around the corner. I was like, okay. And I went to the office and they had my letters on the wall. And they went, and Peter walked in and there was a guy called Robert Popper who now does Friday Night Dinner. He writes all those sort of amazing comics. I mean, he did the In-Between, all sorts of stuff. But so I go in to the office and Peter goes, this is Gail, the one that's been writing us the letters. And they all looked at me like I was a stalker. And I went, oh, I'm not a stalker. It's just a, oh no. And then they gave me a job.
Jeez.
So I know, it was just kind of luck. And it was another one and I didn't get paid, but I was working with, I think it was something for BBC Radio 4. So I was doing the running again, making sure that everybody had their teas and coffees. And it was Keith Allen, Stephen Fry. It was quite a cast. Wow. And from there, I can't actually really remember. There was an audition for a show up in Scotland called the Totally Interactive Game Show. And another one of the directors that I babysat for, he said, I'm directing this new show. You'd be great. And so I rocked up at the interview and there was just hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of like bubbly girls and boys auditioning for this thing. And I thought, I'll never get it. And I queued up like everybody else and went into the audition. But I think the good thing for me was because I'd worked behind the cameras for so long that I was not, that didn't faze me in any way whatsoever. It was kind of, there's a cameraman and it's fine, we're all doing a job. Went in, did the audition, got a job in a pub in Edinburgh. And then I was getting more and more phone calls going, oh, you've got down to the last 25. Oh, you got down to the last 20. And then it kept going down. And you're the last three. And I was like, oh my God, my first ever audition. And then I got the job. And it was a live game show on Children's ITV called The Totally Interactive Game Show. And then it all kind of took off after that.
And that's what...
Kind of the girl next door thing. I was the girl next door. And yeah. I was always excited.
Yeah, enthusiastic. And what is inspiring about your story is, and it's for any young people coming into the industry, I always tell people when they ask me about how to get into radio, I say, learn how to say yes. All right, just say yes. And if you don't know how to do the job, learn how to do it. But just say yes, be enthusiastic. That Gail Porter then was was keen, was enthusiastic, would do the hard work, to do it for nothing. You applied to be the Blue Peter presenter as well, and you didn't get it.
Yes, that's right. Thank goodness for that. I didn't want it. Oh. I really didn't want it because it was the days when, you know, you'd pick up the paper on a Sunday and there'd be some story about someone with, you know, stuff in the closet, skeletons in the closet. And I remember getting down and down and it was really squeaky clean. And I'm not squeaky clean. I might look sometimes okay, but no, I was thinking, oh my God, I did this in the past and I've done that in the past. And oh my
God, we've all done that.
And I just thought, and then they said, oh, unfortunately, you didn't get it. I was like, yes. I just did not want to do Top of the... I didn't want to do Blue Peter at all. I was really dreading it. Because I liked... I mean, it looks fine, but it was never my sort of programme that I watched as a kid. I like, you know, people on roller coasters eating ice cream and trying to present... just fun things. And I think Blue Peter was a bit too grown up for me.
When you were on Top of the Pops and you're working with Chris Cowan, the producer... You said this thing, and I saw your documentary, great documentary, still in the iPlayer at the moment as well. You were saying
thank you.
It's terrific, really great. Because I suffer with my own mental health issues as well, and it's great for people to talk about it. What got me was that you talked about really poignantly that you didn't want to leave the Top of the Pops team because they were your family, and they were the people that looked after you. And so you didn't want to go home because as soon as that door shut at home, it was all behind
you.
Aye. Tell me, was that the start of your mental health issues or was it before then?
Yeah, I think it was way before then. I had problems with sort of eating and the way I looked and all sorts from about 16 or 17. And... yeah, just I always felt there was something not quite right, and I'd go on massive highs. And you know, even if my friends used to come over after school, I didn't want them to leave. And then they'd go, and then I'd be in my room on my own again. I didn't like it. But then I also like being on my own. But then I get overexcited when I'm doing something, and then I don't want to leave that thing. But then other times, like recently with this whole pandemic going on, Christmas Day, my daughter was at her dad's because he lives in Sussex and it's all been a bit difficult trying to figure out how it all works. I'm in London. So I just switched the phone. I said, Happy Christmas, switched the phone off, and I was in my bed for 2 days, which is really bad because usually I get up, go for a walk, do anything. I just couldn't get myself out of it. So yeah, it's been sort of like that since I was a teenager, and it's taken all different shapes and forms, whether it's been undereating, overeating, hurting myself, going on self-destruct or not going out at all and going AWOL and people don't know if I'm okay or if I'm not okay. I sometimes forget that people might try and phone. I just switched the phone off for a couple of days and then eventually got people at the door going, where are you? I said, I was just in bed.
I want to take you into your next room now, 2014, and you're in the room of a friend because you've got you're homeless, so you're living in the room with several of your friends I want to talk about your friendships as well, but you were homeless and living in somebody else's house for a bit. Tell me about that and what led to you being homeless, do you think?
Oh, God. Well, that's pretty simple. I just wasn't earning enough money. My hair had fallen out. The jobs weren't coming in. TV was changing. It wasn't sort of, you know, they got the younger presenters in for Top of the Pops because it was taken when Chris Cowie was edged out of Top of the Pops. They brought in Andy Peters to produce it. And so he decided we were all too old. So he got rid of us. And so like me, Jamie Theakston, Zoe Ball, everyone, we're gone, see you later. But we were all chucked out, and then the jobs you were getting, they just weren't, people assume that if you work in telly you must be getting loads of money, and a lot of jobs you were doing for free, or you know, you get a basic fee to turn up on a show. And then when my hair fell out, all I seemed to be good for was going on to chat shows to talk about being bald. And they don't really pay. So no money was coming in. And, you know, my daughter was, my husband, we got divorced. And it was just one thing after another. So I was living in a tiny flat and I just couldn't afford the rent. It was that simple. I could not afford the rent. I had no money, no jobs coming in. I'm not the sort of person that I don't have a car. I don't go on posh holidays or anything like that. It was just basically day to day. I couldn't survive in London. And then I was homeless, but I had lots of great friends that said you could stay on the sofa. But it's a bit embarrassing at my age, you know. I was thinking, oh God, and they've got kids and, you know, going through their own problems, divorces or happy families. And then my friend, she let me stay in her spare room for a long time. Until I could try. I didn't think I was going to get out of it, to be honest with you. I just thought, I can't believe it. I've got no hair. My mum had passed away. I was just like, it's just one thing after another. And if I didn't have my daughter, I wouldn't be here today, because I was at my lowest ebb, just thinking. There was times I didn't even go to my friend's house and I'd pretend I was staying somewhere else and I'd stay outdoors just because I was so embarrassed about the whole situation. And people would say to me, oh, you didn't phone me. I was like, I don't think you understand. I couldn't even afford to phone people. Yeah. That's how skint I was. If I used to find like £2 somewhere in my bank, I'd be so delighted. That's how skint I was. It was literally that.
Because the bit that really got me was you're talking about Hampstead Heath, and you had to sleep in a park bench one night.
Sat on it all night, but with my eye, one eye open, just thinking, oh my God, what's
that's a way to say. But the thing that got me was you said that you felt a sense of relief as you were on this park bench. What would you mean by that? What was the sense of relief?
I think it was just sitting down, because, you know, I had a big bag with me with all my essentials in it and not knowing where I was going. And I was aimlessly walking thinking, I don't know what to do with myself. I don't know. I'm too embarrassed to go back to my friends. I'm mortified by the whole situation. I felt like I'd let everybody down. And then I sat down on Hampstead Heath and it was getting late. And it was really quiet and it's so peaceful. I don't recommend this, kids. Don't go and hang around in park benches at night. But it was fine. It was a peaceful night. I think it was a bit rainy, but it wasn't anything too bad. And I just thought, right, I put my bags down. Nobody bothered me. Well, it's the middle of the night, really. Got to the middle of the night, no one's around. And if they are around, they probably don't want to get caught. So, it was kind of okay. And it's pretty cold, but I just sat there thinking, oh my God. I've worked so hard all my life and I've really tried and I've tried to be bubbly and then my hair fell out and I was just like, come on. And then I went to stay with a friend again. So she got me in. But even then it was just, I felt like I was in the way and I was constantly trying to get out of the house, pretending I had places to go. I didn't have anywhere to go. And I've got my cat in a box. So I had to give my cat to one of my neighbours who only had a studio flat, and it was her and her boyfriend in one studio. So they took the cat from me for a while. So the cat's been on quite an adventure
Show business is a cold world, isn't it? When you go out of fashion, and especially with the alopecia and everything. And I take your point about you're always that person to go to as well. But was there any sense of show business keeping in touch, or were you just left out in the cold, literally?
I think I'd changed my number by that point and I didn't have an agent, and it's not the fact that they didn't get in touch. They probably didn't know where I was, or if they did get in touch through somebody, it would be, would you do something for charity or would you do something for for having alopecia, which I don't mind in the slightest. But when that's the only things that you get and they're not paying anything, and I just couldn't keep going doing work for free all the time because I'd just still be on a park bench.
Yeah, we can talk as late, and you can tell me to shut up if you want, Gil. But you have talked about your self-harming as well, and you tell this story about when you were self-harming, and actually in work, you were actually getting the makeup ladies people to actually cover up your scars as well, and I thought, you know, that again, this public persona person. And then just before you go on air, you're getting somebody to cover up these scars, which you say were giving you a sense of relief when you did it. Did that add to your problems then? You were living a lie, as it were.
Yeah, well, that was quite a tricky one, because I was lucky enough that the makeup artists that I worked with on a lot of programmes, I knew and they knew. And they were always great. They talked to me. They didn't really understand it. Some did, some didn't. But they'd always make sure that I would get in before everybody else got in. And they'd sit down and talk to me and I'd probably have a good cry. Then they'd do my face. Or sometimes they'd do my arms first because then I'd cry again. Then they'd have to do the makeup all over again. So I used to, and if I was doing a photo shoot, I was lucky enough at the time to usually work with the same people again. So they'd say, do you have a preferred makeup artist? And I'd say my friend Carlos or Jackie, and they exactly knew, so they'd get in early. So we'd be in there before the photographers, before the stylists, sort the scars out, and usually say, can we wear a long sleeve top? Or, but some of the photographers, you know, in the days of photoshopping, they would just photoshop the scars out for me. It's strange, silly times, but...
Were you getting any help then, Gail? Were you seeing any doctors about this?
No, I went to my doctors so many times and they would always say, well, you know, could you come back in 3 months when we've got the mental health assistant team in? And I was like, I might not even be here in 3 months. I was like, I can't, I don't know. I'm so depressed. There was one time I actually went to the doctors and I got on my knees. I was crying so much. And the woman was like, I don't have any appointments. And I said, I need to see someone now. I just need to talk to somebody because I'm just going off my head here. And she's like, I'm just sorry, and turned me away. And that was it. So I gave up. I thought, I'm never going back to a doctor's again. That's it. I'm done.
Of course, you were sections as well. And that was actually, to be honest, I was going to put you in that room. And I thought, no, I'm not going to go there because that'll be sore to go there. Because I think we can talk about it. It was a tough time for you. And what strikes me as well, I'll take you into your last room in a minute, is you look like somebody who's been looking for happiness and a diagnosis. You've been looking for something. You've always, even in the documentary and anything I've seen written, you've always been trying to wonder what is not clicking in your brain. You know, what is it? And it's the same with happiness, that it's trying to identify when you're happy. Would you agree with that?
Oh, definitely. When we did the documentary, I thought maybe 5 different diagnoses by 5 different doctors. And I think by the end of it, I was just like, you know what, I guess I'm just me and that's the way it is. And I don't take medication, but that's just a personal choice because I've tried it before and it made me much worse. I tried whole different ones and it just didn't work for me whatsoever. So I thought exercise and friendships are the things that keep me going. And my daughter, obviously, but now she's 18 in it. So...
Good luck, everybody.
You know what it's like. Yes. You've got a son. I don't really want anyone to say you've definitely got this or you've got that. I just know that I can either be extremely high or extremely low. Sometimes I have the wee middle ground, but that kind of scares me because I'm not sure what's going on. But I do take things very personally. I cry a lot. I pretend to be really tough and Scottish and, you know, stoic, and then I'll be watching something on the telly and I'll be crying my eyes out. And my daughter's like, are you serious, Mum? We've seen this film 3 times. She went, it's not even sad. I was like, I know. But things just start, I don't know. I am just who I am, I guess.
Yeah.
And I think I'm going to be 50 in March. So,
well,
another lockdown birthday.
Well, I keep boring the kids, and because it's suddenly clicked in that I'm 64 this year. I can't believe it. And I keep telling everybody, I don't know why I wasn't saying I was 63 last year, but I was telling the kids, I'm 64 this year. And I just feel as daft as ever was. And I hope that continues.
I still feel like a child. I feel like I'm 18. I get so excited about things that are not really that exciting.
Your final room I'm going to take you into, Gail, is... Yep. Usually, I usually go with the happy room and I ask people what, because I know, looking at the documentary, your happy room is where you are right now, because you're in the flat that you rent that Big Brother got you into. Let's fill a wee bit of the gap in there and we'll talk more about the happiness aspect. Tell me about the Big Brother experience and, you know, it helped to fund the flat.
Yeah, well, this was... I was homeless and I was staying at my friend's, and she was acting as a kind of agent for me. So she was going out to try and help find some work, but it wasn't really happening. And then she got a phone call from Big Brother And she said to me, would you do Big Brother? And I was like, oh my gosh, I couldn't think of anything worse. I said, but yeah, I'll say yes. Like you say yes. You know, what's the worst that can happen? Oh yeah, I got in. But so I said yes, and I had to go for all these psychological interviews, make sure that I was going to be fine. And this went on for a long time. And so I was backwards, forwards. And they knew I was homeless. So I think I was the lowest paid person ever on Big Brother. But I didn't care because it, you know, it gave me enough money to put a deposit on a rented flat. That was it. So yeah, they said they wanted me, then they didn't want me, then they did want me. So I was sort of 1 minute thinking, oh, right, okay, what's the worst that can happen? I'll get voted out in the first few days anyway, because I'm quite boring. Little did I know it stayed till the blinking end. I was like, kept going into the room once I actually got into the house. Very weird. I kept going into Big Brother and buzzing the buzzer, and they go, what is it, Big Brother, come in. And I go in, I said, please vote me out. Please, I'm begging you, vote me out, get me out of here. Because if you walk, you don't get paid. So so I just kept going in every day, going to the public, please, if you're watching this, just get me out of here, please. And no one voted me out until ages. But it gave me, I think I got paid about a month after I came out of Big Brother, and it was the best feeling in the world, because I'd been lent the money from my friend to put, because she knew obviously the money was going into her bank account because she was acting as my agent. So we put the deposit on it. And so I came back, I had no furniture, nothing, when I got voted out. Didn't care. I was just lying here thinking, I've got a roof over my head, and that's amazing. So I never take for granted having a roof over my head at all.
You're writing now. You're doing your own biography as well. Your autobiography. You've written that. You're making documentaries. Do you feel that you've found some happiness now?
Yeah, I feel like, yeah, I'm in such a happy place. You know, I still have my bad days. Don't get me wrong. My daughter's 18 and she's got a boyfriend, and you know, she stays at her dad's. She comes here at the weekend. So I do get quite lonely. Poor cat. Like my daughter says when she comes at the weekend, she said, Mum, this is my life, right? This is you, Mummy. Honey, watch this. Honey, look at me. Honey. She's like, that's all I get all night. She's like, shut up, Mum. I was like, no, but look at this. Honey, watch Mummy. She's like, what's wrong with you? And I said, I sit on my own. And especially through the pandemic, I'm like waving out the windows at people. And Honey's going, who's that? I went, I don't know. Just like, I just feel it's nice to spread a bit of happiness. But I feel content, and the documentary I was a bit worried about doing, because I thought it was going to lay a lot of things out there, but then we won a BAFTA for it. Yeah. So, you know, wow. So yeah. it was a lot of hard work, and the team put up with me because I was all over the place. I was crying.
Wow, it was tough.
Yeah. It was hard, and it was a lot of filming, and it was sort of 6 months of living in each other's pockets and going through my past. And then I was sitting thinking, oh my gosh, I really was slightly crazy. And but yeah, it was hard work, but the team did an amazing job. And since then, I think people have kind of looked at me in a bit of a different way, and it's opened up different kinds of doors, like you said, documentaries and stuff. And I love documentaries, and I think I'm doing another one with BBC Scotland this year. So like, that's any excuse to come home.
Yeah,
because obviously I've not been home since this all started. So yeah, a year, because I used to go to Scotland every few weeks, you know, up and down and up and down, but obviously can't do that anymore.
It's reassuring to hear you talking like this, because you know, there are worrying bits that we've seen in the documentary, but it is reassuring. There's a light at the end of the tunnel. I mean, that's all we're getting at the moment from the government about the pandemic. But it's the way you've got there. It's unconventional. You know, you don't take medication, and you've tried to kind of be yourself and be honest. And that doesn't always go down well. It doesn't, certainly in show business. Can we say then you're happy, and what brings you joy? What are the things? I can hear that Honey brings you joy when she comes and sees you. Your cat does, definitely your cat, who's been in and out of the shot. What else brings you joy? What are the things that wag your tail?
Do you know what? Seeing other people happy, having my evening phone calls for my mates unexpectedly, which is always nice. Movies. I love my movies. When I'm in a bit of a weird place, I watch movies every day practically because I'm not a very good sleeper, so I should really switch the telly off, but I have the telly off for about an hour and a half and I'm like, oh, I still can't sleep, may as well watch something or read something. So yeah, just really basic things, going to the park, I don't know, and fun fairs.
Oh,
I
love
fun fairs. Oh, I love them. We always have Winter Wonderland here in London. And so when the pandemic started, everyone was going, oh, no, we're going to stay. And I went, oh, Winter Wonderland. They're going, Gail, there's a pandemic. I'm like, that means we can't go to the fair at Christmas. But then once I got my head around, it was actually very serious. I was like, oh, this is quite serious. We can go to the fair another time. But, yeah, just like people being happy and just, yeah, being outdoors a lot. I like being outdoors.
What would you have said? What would you have said to the young Gail Porter now? You know, that when he was working for nothing, getting coffee, doing the laundry, babysitting. What would you say? Do you have any regrets?
No, there's no point in regrets. I think it's a waste of an energy. But I'd probably say to young Gail, you better put a seatbelt on and get saving now, whatever cash you've got, pop it in the bag. I mean, and look after that hair of yours because you're not going to have it for much longer.
Yeah. It's been great talking to you, and you are an inspiration. You certainly are, and certainly for honesty as well. Just the way you've conducted yourself, and you talk openly. And you know when you go and meet the people in your past as well, and there was that moment when you saw your dad in a pub, and it is very funny in this respect, Gail. And I know sadly your dad passed away. But that kind of laconic father thing, my dad was brilliant as well. But I always had I'm from Ayrshire, but there was always this kind of Scottish thing, don't get ideas above your head, all right? Don't you think, all right? And I think that lives in the Scottish psyche, whether you're an East Coast or a West Coast, there's this idea of keep your feet in the ground, you know? And sometimes we didn't always realise we had to keep our feet in the ground.
No, exactly. There's one point, like when I was meeting my dad in the pub, because I'd said, we'll meet for coffee. And he's going, no, we'll meet in the pub. Typical dad. And then, so we went to his local pub, sat in the seat that he had. I think half of him was kind of proud because he was taking his daughter to the pub, but then he won't tell you he's proud.
No.
But I kind of, maybe that's just me having wishful thinking. But then I said to him, I say, I'm really sorry if I let you down, dad. And he says, no, you just let yourself down. I was like, what?
Yes, that was the moment I thought, no, dad, Lander here, Lander. Said, no, we all make mistakes in our lives and everything. No, you didn't let me. You let yourself down, which was a bigger slap than anything else. But that's dad's for you, isn't it?
Yeah, exactly. But he lived in Spain at the time, so he was backwards and forwards to Edinburgh. And did he get to see it? I think he did see it before he died. And I said, hey, Dad will be getting a BAFTA next. And he went, oh, I don't think so. And then he died and I got a BAFTA. And yeah. I was like, damn it. So I'm sure he knows I've got it. I've not even seen the BAFTA. He's probably seen it more than I have. I don't know where it is.
Let's look then. You're in the happy house. You've got your flat, your rented flat. You're going to make documentaries. Is there anything else you want to do? Is it more writing? Is it more filmmaking? What do you find? Are you going to do what seems to be in your career is bounce into the next gig? You know, and you know, are you going to chase like you used to do in your 20s, or are you going to let the stuff come to you?
I think I've got quite a lot coming up this year. Obviously, it's all changed because of what we can and can't do. But I'm keeping in a positive frame. I love doing my writing. There's stuff in the pipeline, maybe making something into something, which I don't want to jinx. But I'm going to plod along. I'm not going to be like, I mean, you know, I miss things like, I miss the old telly. I miss the Big Breakfast. I miss Top of the Pops. I miss fun telly. There's nothing I could actually put on the telly now and think, oh, I can't wait till that comes on.
Yeah.
Nothing in the morning that I think, oh yeah, you know, Channel 4, 7 o'clock in the morning, Big Breakfast, don't know what's happening, but you know, we were all having fun. That telly's sort of gone. I think it should all come back.
So do I.
We need a Top of the Pops.
Oh gosh, I loved the big breakfast, just a bit blew the back of my head off when it came on. I just went, oh, this is, and I was an older person as well. It's just brilliant. Well, Gail, thank you so much for your time. I'm going to watch your career now as well. And I thoroughly, everybody, go on, it's on the iPlayer. The documentary is just a magnificent piece of television. And it's made it by just your sheer honesty and putting yourself through that as well, Gail. I suppose... you know, you wish you maybe had been born in the West Coast instead of the East Coast. Yeah, that's the only kind of maybe regret.
I love all parts of Scotland, but Edinburgh girl. But yeah, I miss Scotland like crazy. I really do. I miss even because my friend said, "Well, you can't if you did come up now, which you're not allowed to. There's nothing open." I went, "I don't care. It's just being in Scotland." You know, going for your nice walks, going up Arthur's Seat, stuff like that. I miss all that. You know, here, I just walk right to the bottom of the street and just like, yes, I've been mugged. Woo!
That's brilliant.
Nobody would mess with me anyway. I think everybody knows me, the wee bald Scottish one. Yeah, no, just leave her alone.
A massive thanks to Gail Porter. That's the last in this series of In The Room. I just wanted to say a huge thank you to all of our amazing guests, and we'll be back soon with a special American episode of In The Room with Donald Trump's one-time spokesperson, Anthony Scaramucci. We'll see you next time in The Room.